Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back, Sports to the Max. Dr. Johnny Tower will take a St. Thomas team to play Augsburg tomorrow if he can get out of the alley. What happened to you, man? They claimed you, too, as a victim that snow did, huh?
They got me, Mike. I'll tell you, coming home, quick trip to the grocery store, and I don't know. We're stuck. About 30 minutes of digging out, and I'm still there. So I left it out there. The neighbors, they're probably upset, so I hope they're listening. They give me a little forgiveness here.
Well, the alleys don't get plowed right away, I assume, or do you get plowed those on your own?
They have not been plowed very well. Now, St. Paul, we don't always get the greatest plowing immediately. So we'll be shoveling out tonight, but that's all right. That's what you love about Minnesota. It feels like playoff time.
Oh, it does. It feels great. Except for what you just said. Every once in a while, you get stuck. You don't want anybody to get hurt, any of that stuff. But yeah, other than that, it's a great time of the year. It feels like Minnesota, like you said, playoffs on the horizon. Everything's going. It's a lot of fun. You get Augsburg tomorrow, and that was, I'm sure you're there scouting it last night. That was quite a finish.
Yeah, it was, this time of year, you're going to see teams all playing their best and playing with a lot of desperation. And they've, Augsburg's had a great season. They're really explosive. They got, I think, one of the best, if not the best player in the country, Booker Copeland, a kid from Shakopee, who's just, his numbers are, I think, unparalleled around the country if you look at them. And he hit a tough three at the buzzer last night to move them into the semis tomorrow. And it should be – we've had two wild games with them already this year, one in triple overtime and the other was a two-point game. And so it should be – anybody looking for something to do tomorrow night, it should be a great atmosphere.
Is it 8 o'clock start?
8 o'clock tip.
So what, I don't understand it. You guys play at 8 in St. John's. They play at 7. Why is that?
Yeah, so we're doing it's a doubleheader. Our women play at 5.
Okay, so if they're in the playoffs at the same site, they play them back-to-back.
Correct, but they do clear the gym, so that's why there's a three-hour gap, whereas most of the time during the year when we play doubleheaders, it's 2 hours. So, we'll tip off at 8. St. John's and Bethel play at 7.
Now I got it. So when you talk about the culture of a team, we were just talking about this earlier, how do you assess and how do you know if you have good culture or not on your basketball team?
Yeah, culture is one of those ubiquitous words that I think it sort of means everything, but it's also a little fuzzy and hard to define for the reasons you allude to, that it's difficult to measure. I've taught a course in cross-cultural psychology and several times, and we probably spend the first 3 weeks trying to define culture, and I'm not sure we ever get much closer than we started, because it's everything from, are your kids excited when they walk into practice, to how do you perform in late games, to what do kids do in the off season when we can't work with them. So it really, I mean, culture is, it's those things that are explicit and implicit. It's difficult to measure, but I do think it's palpable when you have it, and because I think you see more than anything, the two words that I'll use a lot, toughness and togetherness, that teams play tough when they've dug a hole for themselves, and they stick together through adversity. And so those are the things that define a really strong culture, toughness and togetherness.
Let me add something that's kind of akin to that, but this is a theory I have, okay? Now, I'm not a psychologist, so I want to run this by you. I believe that everybody is selfish, okay, that innately we're hardwired to be selfish, that we're hardwired, we're driven to achieve all those things. But you can be selfish and be unselfish at the same time. Being selfish means this is what I want for me, but I recognize that that's not as important as I do this for the betterment of the team. In other words, there's a guy on second base, and you really want to drive him in, but the coach believes if you bunt him over to third base, you're going to have a better chance to get the guy in. Well, you want to get the RBI. That's the selfish nature that you have. The selfless is you can recognize that, rise above it, and still bunt the ball. Am I onto something?
I think you are, Mike. I'd agree. We all have selfish tendencies, right? And that stems in part from our desire to survive. But if you really get down to evolutionary theory, You know, we all do what we can every day to survive, and that, but that also can cultivate selfishness in other areas that we wouldn't want, right? In basketball, it's, well, I'm trying to impress the coach and get more playing time, so I'm going to try and score versus I'm going to make the right play, which is the extra pass. And I think as a coach, a big part of the culture you do try to develop is where players truly, you know, they trust one another. They're willing to do whatever it is that the coach and team feels is best for the team. And a lot of that stems from love, right? When you love one another and you're willing to sacrifice, I think that's where trust comes from, being in tough situations and realizing this guy's got my back and I have his back. And those are not easy things to do. I mean, the difficult part, as you and I have talked about in sports, it's zero sum. So every night you're putting yourself on the line and one team wins and one team loses. And you could have two teams with both with phenomenal cultures and one of them's still going to lose. So I think that's the other part, that you can't let culture be completely correlated with winning percentage or success in terms of wins and losses, because, you know, at the end of the year, the teams in the playoffs, those, they've demonstrated great culture all year. And in Division III, out of 425 teams, only one of them is going to emerge as national champs. That doesn't mean there aren't dozens of others that don't have great culture.
Let me throw another one by you that as years of added wisdom. You know, I can remember when I played in high school and a college coach would come out to watch me play, and I got recruited by a lot of the MIAC schools, et cetera. And I thought, you need to put up points. You need to really be impressive. You know, you need to do something, you need to splash. Not that there's not some truth to that. You need to stand out in some way, shape, or form. But what I realize now is good coaches can tell a good player, and they don't need to see a stat line. They can just tell if a guy can play. Is that true when you go watch a game? Do they need to do something that really impresses you statistically, or can you just tell?
Absolutely. We don't pay very much attention to statistics when we recruit, quite frankly. You know, I think as a basketball coach, it's easy to get seduced and enamored by jumping ability, spectacular plays, height. Those are all things that, and those aren't bad things, but when you look at what really translates and is sustainable, it's kids who are tough-minded on defense and they're unselfish on offense, and they're willing to turn down a good shot for a great shot. And so those are the things that, those are harder to measure because you really have to watch a kid repeatedly. Usually the first time you see somebody play in high school, you may not notice all of those things, but it's, you know, it's the larger sample size. And once you start to accumulate data, and after the third or fourth time, and you realize, God, this kid's willing to turn down open shots and he's only averaging 8 points a game, but he's shooting 60% and he's got a great assist to turnover ratio. And all of a sudden you're like, this is a kid that's going to fit in our program. And those are the things that we value. You know, we're first in the country in assist to turnover ratio right now. And that to me is a number that is really important because it demonstrates two things: unselfishness with the ball and toughness with the ball. And if you do those two things, you usually have a chance to win.
How do you teach a kid not to turn the ball over? And how do you teach a kid not to turn the ball over and still to play with a freedom and not allow fear to overtake him?
Yeah, that's a difficult thing. There's no question balancing, because in practice you want them to play free, and we want to be able to identify who can play at the pace we want to. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, we're averaging somewhere around 9 turnovers a game, and we play 10 guys a game. So it doesn't take a math guru to realize that means that if you're turning the ball over a lot, if you're not a point guard and you're turning the ball over more than one time a game, it's going to be hard to be on the court. Because if we've got everybody, if we've got all 10 guys who get 2 turnovers a game, just 2, which doesn't seem like a ton, right? A lot of high school players, that transition, it takes a little while, because you realize if every one of our guys has 2 turnovers a game, that's 20 turnovers a game, and we're going to be a really pretty abysmal team. So I think a lot of it, it's, you know, some of it is you hope they come from great high school programs, which most of our guys do, and then some of it is what you demand. I mean, it's not as much teaching passing technique. You might teach awareness, and you might do some toughness, ball toughness drills, but a lot of it is just demanding that, hey, there's a threshold for the risk-reward of any pass. And I think it's getting players to understand that they need to throw less risky passes. That's probably the simplest way.
And you try to simplify it to that so it doesn't begin to infringe on what it is they want to be as a player. It's just, it's that half a second more thought process.
Absolutely. I mean, you can, you know, in psychology, we talk about paralysis by analysis, that you can think too much, and the best players and the best teams, they're really not thinking out there. They're on automatic pilot because of how they've practiced and rehearsed. But you do have to have a thoughtfulness of what's the time, what's the score, what's the situation. And that's the beauty of sports, right? It's easy to be an armchair quarterback. I mean, this is what I love about coaching at St. Thomas and in Division III. These are student athletes that, you know, this is a part of their day. It's an important part of their education, but they're getting to make decisions on the fly and doing this with their teammates that is going to, that's building skills that's going to serve them the rest of their lives. And I feel incredibly fortunate to get to work with these guys.
What's your philosophy on shooting in terms of if a guy's a good shooter, does anybody get the green light, so to speak? Because you, again, this gets into the psychology of fear and everything else. You can't be a good shooter if you're shooting with fear. You got to be loose, just like when you're in the driveway and you make 10 in a row. That's where you want to be at when you get the open shot in a game. Easier said than done. How do you try to create that?
Yeah, well, if you watch us play, just about everybody's got the green light. We're not the biggest team. We're not the fastest team, but we do pass it and shoot it pretty well. And I think a lot of it is, you know, you have to prove in practice, you have to earn that. But what we tell most of our guys is if you're out on the floor, here are the shots that we're comfortable with you taking. And if you're open, you better shoot it. And then there are other guys where you may limit that a little bit and say, hey, you're open with under 10 seconds left in the shot clock. You got the green light shooting threes. I will tell you more of our guys, we get on our guys more and get upset with them more for not shooting open shots than we do for taking tough shots, because they probably err on the side of being unselfish, and it's a good problem to have. But, you know, you also try to – this is the decision-making part that's so complex, because really you're working within every possession. It's like a little mini game, and you're trying to get a great shot. And, you know, if you pass up a great one, you may not get another look at it. And so it's you know, it's constantly sort of this game theory model of how do you take the highest percentage shot, but – don't pass up an opportunity you may not have again, and do that on the fly in real time, and then transition back to defense and do that 70 times a game. It's the beauty of basketball. You know, there's no stop and start. It's not football where you get 30 seconds to huddle back up and, you know, figure out what you're doing next. You keep going and going.
That's what you tell Caruso too, right? Anybody could do that. Take time. Let's think about this.
Absolutely. Just today he was explaining to me why football is a superior sport to basketball.
No.
Yeah, you can guess that we didn't resolve that one, but absolutely.
Some things need to not be resolved either. They just need to be continuous discussion. Now, you have a son that plays, and he's getting older in the food chain as a sophomore. How are you different as a parent than a coach?
Well, I mean, I have two boys. They're in 10th and 8th grade, and the 10th grader's on the varsity and not playing much on the varsity at Crete and Durham, but playing in the junior varsity and getting a little time. And the 8th grader's at a Highland Catholic grade school. And, you just as a parent, you try and sit back and enjoy watching them play.
But you get nervous too, don't you?
Oh, sure. When you're a parent, you feel differently than a coach. There's no doubt, because you want them to be successful and you want them to have great experiences. At the same time, I think as a parent, the two things I try to always do is, number one, be loving and supportive after games, because it's, you know, sports are emotional and you want them to know they have that unconditional love and support. But then the second thing is, when they're ready, to try to help them break down the game and not in a way where you're preaching and lecturing, but more asking questions on why did they make this decision and that decision and how could they handle that differently in the future, whether it's communicating with teammates, with coaches, you know, late game situations. I think the beauty of that is where they see that, look, sports is important, but it's not life and death. We're blessed to do this. And sports, way too often, I think I see kids being stressed out and even not having fun versus, you know, let's make sure we keep this in perspective, that sports is part of the educational process. And if our kids can learn those lessons and they're better off tomorrow than they were today, then losing a game or not playing as many minutes as you might like, that's not the end of the world. In fact, what a great opportunity to be a little bit better the next time out.
Do you believe that, let's just say a kid's goal is to play on the varsity basketball team, and, you know, kind of a common goal for a lot of people throughout Minnesota, I would imagine. Do you believe that they develop more by playing against teams where they can do well and gain confidence, you know, along the elementary, junior high, and JV route, or by playing against great competition that while they may not do well, could also hurt their confidence? Is there a best way to develop a player so that he by the time he's a junior or senior, he's ready?
You know, Mike, I think really it's a combination of the two. And I don't say that as a cop-out. I say it because if a kid, you know, sometimes you see kids so dominant in ninth and 10th grade that they don't have to work on their weaknesses and they don't necessarily develop the requisite skills to then excel when they're in college. You see other kids who are pretty good, but they kind of get their confidence shattered because they're either going against kids every day in practice or in their league where they're not having much success. And so I think, I'm jumping around a little bit, but I think one of the benefits of AAU basketball is trying to find a different experience so that maybe you're the star in your high school team. Try and play on an AAU team where you might be the fifth or sixth or seventh best player. Or flip it around. Maybe you're a role player on your high school team and you're not playing a ton. Maybe you want to be on an AAU team where you're going to be more of the first or second option, because I really think in terms of learning valuable skills, both of those serve you well in life, right? Wherever you end up in life, there's a decent chance some days you're going to be working at a place where you've got a lot of responsibility, and there are other times where you're going to be at the bottom of the food chain and you got to figure out, how do I work my way up? And if you've never been in both of those situations, you probably missed out on an opportunity.
Which gets me back to my whole, as I wrap this thing up, and why sports is the greatest class you can take. I mean, where else do you have to deal with those high emotions, physical, all that stuff? You can't offer a course like that. And you got to be a good teammate and a good winner and a good loser and all those things. And you get measured, right tomorrow, you'll get measured right in front of your eyes. Excuse me. And you got to figure it out on the fly. And so that's why, I love the kids from the MIAC. Obviously, I'm biased coming from there. But that's what they kind of do all day, every day between classes and sports.
Absolutely. I'm teaching a course in psychology tomorrow on motivation, and the students are awesome in there. The reality is, if they don't get the grade they want on a paper, that's not posted online. That's not posted, written about in a paper. And thousands of other people aren't saying, what happened? Why didn't you do better on that test? And so putting yourself out there in sports, it does create sort of this powerful emotional environment that I think the people who go through that learn valuable skills, that as long as they keep things in perspective, right? And I think that's our job as coaches, as parents, as teachers, to keep it in perspective that, this is all part of the growth and development that, through high school, college, hopefully produces young adults that are going to be the next leaders in society.
Good stuff as always, Dr. John. We'll talk again soon.
Always a pleasure, man.
Go get that van out, man.
Thanks. Good luck.
Yeah, you bet. How appropriate, huh? He had to come in. We're trying to shovel his van out to do the interview, then go back out. This is Minnesota. Take a break. Come back. I think the psychology of sports, and that's why I always like having Johnny on. We already talk about his team. We end up talking about the psychology of sports. I think it's an incredibly fascinating part and tool as to how it's managed and used with players and coaches. Because first, you got to look at yourself and figure out what motivates you, what gets you there. And then the next, I truly believe, and we change our theories over the years, but you need to commend kids that are willing to go play against competition that's better than them, knowing that they're going to play against competition that's better than them, and seek it out. And when they get it handed to them, you got to tell them that's okay. Because now they know what the standard is. Now they know what it is that they're striving for. But if they only get their beat up and their brains beat in, they may become discouraged. But if you can take them aside and say, guess what? I give you a ton of congratulations on that because you went for it. You're up against it. You got beat bad, but you did it anyway. And now we get back to our original conversation. You could have stayed home and played video games, but you didn't. You went out there and got in the game, man, because of all things that you want from yourself and from your kids. Be a participant in life, man. Be a participant. Get whatever that means to you. Don't sit on the sidelines and just criticize and, I could tell them how they could do this better because you're scared to death to do it yourself. Just get out there and participate. And to be a participant means that you're going to do things even when you get your brains beat in once in a while. And you're going to get your butt kicked, and you're going to be humiliated. And you do it anyway because you know that's growth. That's leaving your comfort zone. That's how you get good at things. So you need to encourage and encourage and encourage those kids that go out and put themselves, as we were talking about with Dr. Tower, put themselves, here's the spotlight, all right? You like it? How about when you miss the shot? How about when you're sitting on the bench and you think you should be playing and people are asking you, they're saying you should be playing and you're not? Try getting through those. Try processing that sometime. But we need to encourage the kids that are willing to do that and the people that are willing to do that. And that's where it becomes not about wins and losses, but about the psychology of life. If you can develop that mindset that you're going to be a participant and not just sit on the sidelines, tell others how they could do it better, but you're going to get out there, you're going to get ringside, you're going to get in there, now you're going to have a good life. Now you're going to have fun because you're going to lose some. But you're going to feel so fulfilled and so satisfied that you went for it that will negate the losses times 10. Remember that when you tuck your kids to bed tonight. Take a break. Come back. Sports to the Max. Welcome back. Sports to the Max. Should have played New York, New York coming to this one. Sam Rosen is a staple out there. Has been for years. Part of the New York Rangers broadcast tomorrow night when the Wild come to town. But I've just... He's been in the Big Apple, taking a big bite out of it. Sam, congratulations on a great career.
Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate it. I've had a good run here, and nobody has had it better than me, and nobody enjoys it more than I do.
How'd you get into it, Sam? What was your first gig? How'd you work your way up the ladder?
Starting out as a statistician on the New York Knicks radio network back in 1970, when the Knicks won the NBA championship.
Oh, and wow.
It went from step to step, and from there, and I hooked up with Madison Square Garden as a fill-in guy in the late 70s, and then full-time in early in 1982, and in 1984, they gave me the Rangers job, and I'm still doing it.
Plus some football, plus some other stuff along the way, too.
Got to love the games. Love the games, Mike. Yeah. Just let me know when the next game is and where I have to be.
Is the Garden special to you the way it is to an outsider coming in, or do you get past that at a certain point?
It's still special. You know what? Because everybody knows, even though the basketball team has been down, the hockey team won the championship in 1994, but we've had a good run with the Rangers the last dozen years, it's still a special place. Everybody knows Madison Square Garden. It's right in the heart of New York City. And if there's a big event, it's going on at Madison Square Garden. They've had great boxing matches. You know that. Great concerts. Billy Joel is still headlining and doing concerts at MSG. It's a special place.
Yeah, you know, the first time I went there, the University of Minnesota was playing in the NIT, and of course, the Madison Square Garden, synonymous with the Final Four of the NIT, and they were playing Fresno State, coached by Jerry Tarkanian. Tarkanian, they just done a piece on 60 Minutes, so it was less than flattering, and Mike Wallace came to the game, came out of the crowd before the game, came over to shake Tarkanian's hand, which he would not do. What ensued, I was standing right there, was an argument that I'll never forget, and it was just in a strange way, it was so cool because it was like, here's Mike Wallace and here's the Shark and they're going head to head and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I'm going, wow, this New York City thing's pretty cool. But you know, and that's, you know, that's kind of what it is. So there's just an energy about it and there's just people there that you don't normally see.
Yeah. You know what happens when the basketball team is going well, and even when it's not, they're packing MSG to see the Knicks. And that those front row seats along the side courts, you see great celebrities. With the Rangers, it's similar. When the team is playing well, people want to go to the Garden and be seen. It's the place to be. It gets the attention. I go back 25 years, obviously, to the Rangers championship in 1994. But that was a big time for hockey. Hockey was getting a lot of attention on the cover of Sports Illustrated several times with the Rangers and the NHL as the Rangers made their run to the Stanley Cup. It's the hub, and if something good is going on there, everybody knows about it.
The Rangers have even dipped their toe the last few years in, I don't want to call it rebuilding, but at least getting younger. Can you do that very often in New York, or is it an unforgiving city and you're expected to win all the time?
You know, it's hard to do it, Mike, but you know what the organization did? They made a big decision. They had made the playoffs 10 out of 11 years, and the one year they didn't make it, they lost in a shootout on the last day of the season in Philadelphia. So The team had been to the Stanley Cup final in 2014 and lost to the LA Kings. They could have made the playoffs last year, but they looked and they didn't see anything coming. There wasn't a lot of talent in the cupboard. The cupboard was bare. And so they really made a tough decision, but they let their fans know about it. They said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to make some deals. We're going to get younger, and we're going to build from within and make this a team that can be a solid contender, not only for 1 year, but for several years. And that's what they did. They made big trades. They traded Rick Nash to Boston. They got back value. They traded their captain, Ryan McDonagh,
yeah,
and T. Miller, a good forward, to Tampa. They got back value. They got prospects and draft picks. And now, suddenly, when you look, they've had 5 first-round draft picks the last 2 seasons. They've got some young prospects. They're playing some. They've made some good deals. And they're likely to make a couple before the trade deadline on Monday. But that's the route they're going. It was a tough decision to make, but they let their fans know it up front. And right now, to this point, the fans have accepted it just fine.
Yeah, Ryan McDonagh's a local kid from out here in Minnesota, just a wonderful young man who, you know, is going to Tampa. That was probably a win-win deal, huh?
Mike.
Really?
One of my favorite players. He was a terrific captain. He was a great player in New York, and he's doing a great job down in Tampa. You see what the Lightning are doing right now. They're the best team in the NHL.
What was the biggest that you ever saw in terms of at the Garden and fervor for? Was it the Willis Reed-led Walt Frazier, Earl Monroe, Dave DeBuscher? Was that as big as it ever got there as you look back in retrospect?
Well, I think the two greatest moments, 1970, the Willis Reed coming out in Game 7. I was there. I was a statistician for the Knicks radio network, and the building exploded. Willis came out, hit his first 2 shots, and after that, Walt Frazier took over. And the Knicks beat the Lakers in Game 7 and won their first NBA championship. The other moment was the Rangers winning the Stanley Cup on home ice in Game 7 against the Vancouver Canucks. And the city just went wild. And the place was electric. The fans were great. And then the parade 3 days later on a Friday was just something to behold with well over 1 million people down in the Canyon of Heroes. It was really, really special.
Contrast that to how much have you enjoyed doing the NFL?
The NFL is special, Mike. I mean, let's face it. Football is huge in America. The NFL is the biggest thing going. And you have this one game a week. It's special in every city that there's a game, and the fans know it. They come out in full force. You get real good access to the players and coaches in doing the games. It's really a pleasure to be part of the NFL scene because you know it's such a big sport in America.
You've done the Vikings several times over the years.
I have. I did get to do a Vikings game this past season against Arizona. And quite honestly, at the time that I did it, they looked good. They were they looked like a team that would be strong and make the playoffs and have a good run. And unfortunately, second half of the season, it didn't go well for them.
So it's a lot different in terms of how you prepare for an NFL game where it's obviously completely neutral versus the New York Rangers. Are you allowed to skew a little bit more for the Rangers? How is that different for a broadcaster?
You know what, Mike, as far as Rangers broadcasts are concerned, we've never, and this is the good fortune that I've had, we've never been told this is how we want you to broadcast. We try, myself and Joe Micheletti, who's
another Minnesota boy,
native and one of the greats, he's my partner and has been, this is 13 years that we're together. Prior to that, I worked 20 years with John Davidson, and we've never been told we want you to slant it any one way or the other. We've tried to play it down the middle, but fans know we're New York. We want the Rangers to win, but We always take the approach that there's two teams out there and the other team needs a fair shake on our broadcast, and we try to do that. We always meet with the head coach of the opposing team and several players before the game, and players that we may have relationships with, like Eric Staal of the Minnesota Wild was with the Rangers, sure, at the end of a season a couple of years ago. Zach Parise was a Devil, New Jersey Devil for years, and was in the metropolitan area. So those are players we'll make sure to talk to leading up to the game. And, of course, the head coach, Bruce Boudreau, we know for years when he was in Washington, and he's been around the NHL for several years. So we make sure that we try to find out what's going on with the other team. But let's face it, everybody knows we're the Rangers broadcasters, and if the Rangers win, we're happy and the organization is happy.
Well, you mentioned Mick, Mick Leddy. His son-in-law was at the Wild practice the other day, a guy by the name of Mike Modano.
Yeah,
and they're trying to get him, I think, to be an ambassador of some sort for the Wild. But people probably, only some people probably know that connection, but his daughter married Mike.
Yes, they've been married. They've got several kids, and they've built a wonderful family. And look, Mike, one of the great players of all time, and of course, one of the greatest American-born players, he can only bring good things to any team that he works with. So if he hooks up with the Minnesota Wild, it'll be a plus for the Wild. He's a great guy and a great player and a great person. And Joe, of course, he's got a great family in Minnesota with his brothers and sisters, and it's been wonderful to see them, and he has continuing great relationships there. And Joe's, I don't have to tell you, when Joe comes home, he's a big hero when he goes home.
Sure, yeah. Along those lines, this week we're kind of celebrating the 1980 Miracle on Ice because there's such a Minnesota flavor to it, and it was 39 years ago on Friday that they beat the Russians. But A, how did that? What do you remember about that from where you stood? And then B, of course, we talk about Herb Brooks being from here and the Olympic coach. You worked with him with the New York Rangers.
I certainly did, and one of my favorite people that I've ever met. He had a great impact on me because of the overall great knowledge of the game that he brought. We used to have lengthy discussions after practice, and we'd talk about hockey and talk about not only the NHL, but hockey around the world. Herb was a great, great person and left us too soon. What a shame. But, Herb in New York, you only wanted great things for him. We had one terrific run with his smaller team, and he loved the skating game and was great here in New York. But thinking back to the Miracle on Ice, I was up in Lake Placid working for the now defunct United Press International and covering the Olympics in 1980.
Oh, you
but
were.
I also did a couple of games with the team as they were leading up to it in the fall, leading up to the Winter Olympics. I remember doing a game up at Harvard University when the prospective Olympic team played a game up there, and just seeing the way he put things together, the way he pushed players, and just tried to get the maximum out of every player. He was a special kind of person, a special kind of coach, and of course, to watch what happened at the Olympics in Lake Placid was unbelievable. Their first game was a 2-2 tie, and you just didn't know which way was this team going to go, and suddenly it caught fire and gained confidence, and they believed in themselves, and then when they beat the Russians, that was an incredible victory, and then they still had to beat Finland to win the gold medal, which they went on to do. But it was an unbelievable run for Herb Brooks and the U.S. team in 1980.
Last, Marv Albert and you must have hosted a number of things there for the MSG Network over the years, huh?
Well, you know what? I was lucky enough to be Marv's fill-in when I first started at MSG. He was doing the Knicks and the Rangers on radio.
He was?
I was his fill-in. Yeah. He was doing both on radio. And when he would have a conflict, I would fill in for him. But, yes, I've known Marv for a long time. What a, you know, just a great career that he's had and continues to be the lead guy on TNT with the NBA. Just a terrific career that he's had.
Well, so have you, Sam. We appreciate it very much. I didn't mean to go down so much yesterday, but you got so many great stories I couldn't resist.
Don't mind that at all, Mike. I love it. Anytime you want to have me on, I'd be happy to come on with you.
Sounds good. Have a good broadcast.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Sam Rosen doing the game tomorrow night for the New York Rangers on MSG Network and beyond. Stay with us. We'll wrap up this edition of Sports of the Max when we come back. Welcome back, Sports with Max, News Talk 830 WCCO. That guy can do it, Dave Lee, man. He can just come in, turn it on like a light switch. Take you right through that morning and that cup of coffee and that drive to work. And you don't even realize what he was doing. He makes it look so easy. All great ones make it look easy, even if it's hard. They all make it look easy. And they do that from repetition and coming back at it day after day and honing their skills and cleaning up details and all those things along the ways. Dave Lee's one of those guys. He makes it look easy because he's refined it over the years. He's worked hard at it. He's dedicated himself to the craft over the years. And so it becomes very easy in terms of listening when he gets behind the microphone. We're incredibly lucky to have him here at WCCO and to call him a colleague and a friend. It's pretty cool stuff because old D. Lee can get it done, and he will again tomorrow. And I'll join him at 7:40 and 8:40, and we'll talk about sports stuff. Which, you know, it ranges, depends on what happens tonight, you know. We'll probably talk about Charlie Coyle being traded from the Minnesota Wild to the Boston Bruins. We'll talk about the Gophers playing Michigan tomorrow in a big game. We'll talk about the Timberwolves being back. All that stuff. We'll give different takes on it, different opinions, different little sidelights that you hadn't heard before. Maybe I pick up a little something. I'll be out the Vikings tomorrow. A little something you haven't heard of before. Boom, we'll throw that out there. That's what we do. With D. Lee, you can go any direction you want because he can flat out get it done. And that's a lot of fun. That is a lot of fun. So we'll do that tomorrow. Is it Shaletta in next?
No, it's
Lindsey Gensel's in next. And then, what was I going to say? I thought Shaletta was in. Is that tomorrow? Okay. I started prepping today, so I didn't know for sure. So join us again tomorrow morning with Dave Lee and I get go head-to-head and toe-to-toe. Listen to Lindsey Gensel coming up next, and then we'll take you all through the wee hours and do it again tomorrow. Corey Hepla back in studio from Fort Myers to regale you with some tales from Twin Spring Training and much more. Sports to the Max is now concluding on WCCO.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.